Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, some of you may have expected to see Susan Nelson speaking this morning. She's out of town. She's attending a memorial service, and she'll be back soon. So I stepped in, and I'm going to speak in her place. So I'd like to start by saying Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
The holidays are over, which is okay with me. Christmas especially can be kind of hard on a meditation practice, I've found. Has anyone else experienced that? You get really busy and things happen, and it's just really difficult. But New Year's is great for a meditation practice. That's a different kind of holiday. There are a couple of things about New Year's that really fit with Zen practice. One is that traditionally it's a time to start over. Everyone gets to start over on New Year's Day. When I think of starting over, I think of the acknowledgement of karma that we chant here on Tuesday mornings and Saturday mornings. If you've never been to those chanting services, either very early Tuesday morning or at a more reasonable hour on Saturday morning, they're really beautiful services with a lot of chanting and a lot of bowing. And so come check those out if you haven't done that. But what we chant on those mornings, one of the things we chant is the acknowledgement of karma. All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born of body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. When you say this chant, you acknowledge the mistakes you've made, and in acknowledging them, you get to start over. And New Year is like that. Another thing about New Year's is we make resolutions. We make vows. Perfect for our practice. This also makes me think of that service, the Tuesday and Saturday morning service, in which we chant, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. So every year I get really busy at Christmas time and I get a bit distracted. And every New Year's I basically make the same vow, which is to do this practice that we do, this meditation and mindfulness practice, with a little more effort and a little more focus. And there are variations to that. Sometimes there are more details. This year I am vowing to get up earlier in the morning, really early in the morning, so I can meditate before work, get a little work done at home before work, have more time for breakfast so I'm not rushed. That's what I'm going to try to do. And of course, the hard part will be going to bed early the night before. That's my real challenge. But really, it's all part of the same vow. It's the vow to do this practice with a greater effort, or maybe with greater wisdom. If you've been coming here for a while, you might find yourself making that same vow over and over in different ways at different times, doing whatever works. At many Zen monasteries, people literally take these same vows every day. They recite the acknowledgement of karma. They recite the four vows, which I've recited this morning, as well as the three refuges. It can be very helpful to our practice to recite these things to ourselves, even more helpful to recite them out loud, and even more helpful than that to recite them with other people, so we know that we're not doing this thing alone. Today I'm going to talk about the three refuges. I'm going to talk about what the three refuges are and what it means to take refuge. But before I do that, I'd like to talk about that when we chant the refuges, the acknowledgement of karma, and the four vows here, we do this while making full bows. And bows are pretty essential to the process of taking refuge. So I'd like to talk a little bit about bowing. Perhaps you, some of you I think are new this morning, perhaps you haven't seen full bows, but a full bow involves getting down very low on the floor and raising your hands a little bit like this. It's a real bow. It's a serious bow. This is gassho, which is serious too, but a full bow, that's a real bow. And I'd like to explain this, especially since it can be misunderstood. The first time I walked into a Zen center was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was a Korean Zen temple. And I saw people doing these full bows, which they called prostrations there. And I was a little shocked because I had read quite a lot about Zen. And I knew there was no deity in Zen and there was no worship. And this looked so much like a worshipful posture to me that I wondered what was going on. And I asked my teacher about that, and she said, no, there is no deity. We're not worshiping anyone. We're not asking anyone to come help us or anything like that. And she explained it to me. And I can state really four reasons for doing this bowing. One is that it simply shows respect. It shows respect to the Buddha. Here we have a figure of Manjushri on our altar. It's showing respect for Manjushri. Showing respect for all of these people and beings who have gone before us and have done this practice and have made such a great effort and have taught us how to do this thing. Another reason we bow in this way is it's a reminder of the importance of our task here. Because when we come to Zen Center, we come to Zen Center to deal with the really deep questions, the questions of life and death, the questions of what should be done with a human life. These are the deepest questions there are. This is a serious task. We need to remind ourselves that this is something important. We really want to bring our best self to this effort. And a third reason for bowing is that it brings us to the moment. It helps us to come right to this moment. Because bowing is a little complicated. You have to do it just right. You want to do it with everyone else. You want to do it kind of gracefully. You know, you don't want to just flop down there. To do that, it takes some concentration. So it's about just being. It's about just being in that moment, doing this activity of bowing. And there's really something that is deeper than words about bowing, that after you've done many, many bows, you begin to understand. And finally, the bowing expresses a giving way of approaching life. It's essential to practice that we have a giving attitude. Helping others is part of it. But giving moment to moment, during our meditation, each moment we have the choice to sort of ask something of the moment and say, what can this moment do for me? And what is there about my needs this moment that can be met? Or we can let our needs go. We can set those aside and we can just say, what is it? What is here right now? Not from my perspective. What is really here? That's a very giving attitude, and that's very essential to what we do here. So, back to the three refuges. The three refuges may also be called the three treasures, or the triple treasure, or the triple gem. The Sanskrit word is Trisarana, meaning three refuges, or Triratna, meaning three jewels. And our translation goes like this, and many of you know this by heart, but some of you have never heard it. I take refuge in Buddha. May all living beings embody the great way, resolving to awaken. I take refuge in Dharma. May all living beings deeply enter the teachings, wisdom like the sea. I take refuge in Sangha. May all living beings support harmony in the community completely without hindrance. So we're taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, and the Sangha, which is the group of practitioners. To some people, the three refuges are a formal procedure by which someone kind of publicly becomes a Buddhist. Sometimes that's the understanding, sometimes not. The refuge ceremony is important to all Buddhists everywhere. It's recited throughout the Buddhist world. Taking refuge in the Buddha is finding our home in the example of Shakyamuni Buddha and, by extension, other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, teachers, all of us, the Buddha in all of us. Taking refuge in the Buddha is not putting our trust in some force outside of ourselves that's going to come and save us. Many writers speak about having faith in Buddhism, and there's a word for that in Buddhism, which is shraddha. But it's not blind faith. It's not the kind of faith which says, I'm just going to trust this person no matter what, and this person is going to save me. It's putting our trust only in things that we verified for ourselves. You do need some belief that this is going to help you in order to practice. But you continually measure that against your own experience. We accept the path because we see the truth of it in ourselves. And one way to think of this is, I take refuge in the Buddha in myself. I really like that because it's the Buddha in myself. It's not someone else who's going to do it for me. I have to do it myself. Taking refuge in the Dharma is finding our home in the truth expounded by the Buddha. We practice the way he uncovered. This is study, and it includes things such as reading sutras, reading commentaries on sutras, hearing talks, hearing about the experiences of others. Study like that is essential, but it doesn't mean getting hung up on knowledge. It doesn't mean only having book learning about Buddhism. You can read all of the books downstairs in the library, but if it doesn't inform your practice, if it doesn't inform how you are right now, you'll miss the point. So study is very important, but it is not the whole story. Finally, taking refuge in Sangha means finding our spiritual home with those who live in accordance with the Buddha's teachings. Often in Asia, the word Sangha refers just to ordained people. Here it's more likely to refer to all practitioners of Buddhism. You could say that everyone who practices Buddhism in this country is one big Sangha. It's more often used to express something about a group of practitioners like Zen Center. People who come to Zen Center, that's a Sangha. This group here this morning is a little Sangha which has come together for this one morning. I could talk about Sangha all day and how wonderful it is. It's one of my favorite subjects because I've been coming here for a long time and I am so nurtured by this place and I love this place so much. But that's another talk, really. So I'm just going to say a couple of things. I think Sangha is really essential because it's hard to do this practice on your own because the thread is so subtle and sometimes the thread is no thread at all. And it's easy to miss that. It's easy to forget what's going on there. And you need people around you to remind you of that. And a good Sangha supports you, but it also challenges you because you have to be continually challenged to find that thread, which is not a thread. And Sangha continually reminds you that you're not doing this just for yourself. It's not self-help. It's something that you undertake for all beings. So we might think of the Triple Treasure, or the Three Refuges, as a set of guidelines for following this practice. It's a lot like the Six Paramitas or the Eightfold Path in that sense. The Triple Treasure tells us to emulate the Buddha, to study his teachings, and to do these things with a community of people. I could focus this morning on approaches to doing this, on very practical ways of meditating and being mindful, but I'm not going to do that. That's something we cover in Beginner's Mind and in a lot of the courses we give here. But this morning, I'd really like to talk about our attitude as we do this. I would like to talk a bit about the meaning of refuge. The word refuge, at least when viewed in the conventional sense, sounds protective and comfortable. It sounds really nice. It sounds like returning to the womb or finding a place of rest, being cared for. Like we can let down our effort for a while and just kind of be held. And there certainly is an element of that in taking refuge in the Buddhist sense. There are certainly times when we're cared for by Sangha and we're exhausted or we're hurt and we really need that. But that's not the whole story. And if you think that refuge is just being protected and just being held, you can't fully understand this practice. So when looking at a Buddhist idea, it's always good to start with the translation. And invariably, there are subtleties in the translation. The subtleties in the meaning of the original word that the translation does not capture. And I found a really good source for this, which is Robert Aitken in Taking the Path of Zen. What we translate as I take refuge in the Buddha is in Pali, the ancient Indian language Pali, Buddham Saranam Gacchami. He says that I take refuge may be the best translation when all is said and done, but it's important to examine the Pali words because they have levels of meaning that are not brought out in the English. Buddham is Buddha, of course, and Saranam means protection, shelter, abode, refuge, willed or chosen resort. So protection or shelter. But Gacchami is a verb form meaning going to or will undertake. Undertaking. So it's purposeful. It's active. It's not a kind of giving up. This is really essential. So, Robert Aitken says, a translation of the first line of the Three Refuges could be, I undertake to find my home in the Buddha. I undertake to find my home in the Buddha. He says it's more a vow than a prayer. Although our conventional view of refuge may be a safe place, the meaning of refuge in the context of undertaking is not so much asking to be protected as it is vowing to stay on the path, to make the effort necessary to find our true nature, to not be swept away by desire, to stand up in the moment. So in a way, refuge is not comfort at all. It's about rising above the need for comfort. It's about a refuge that is no refuge. I undertake to not need refuge, and that is my refuge. That's a paradox that acknowledges that we are needful human beings, but on one level at least, we can rise above need. Pema Chodron says this very nicely in The Wisdom of No Escape. She says that taking refuge is not seeking consolation, but is expressing an aspiration to leave the nest, to go forth alone with no hand to hold. It is an acknowledgement that we are the Buddha, one who continually leaps, one who continually opens, one who continually goes forward. That's what it means to be human, she says. That's what it means to be a warrior. So it sounds like the opposite of protection and comfort, doesn't it? She says, taking refuge in the three jewels is no refuge at all from the conventional point of view. It's like finding a desert island in the middle of the ocean after a shipwreck, and then standing there and watching it being eaten away day by day by the ocean. That's what taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is like. Welcome to Zen. That's really tough. That's really tough. Watching the only place you have to stand as it disintegrates. So taking refuge is seeing that ultimately there is nothing to hang on to. All is impermanent. What we think of as the self is an illusion. There is only this moment. What happened last moment can't help you this moment. So taking refuge is being fully awake to everything in the world, including impermanence, including that constant change. So it's about going to that edge again and again, that edge where you see the impermanence, that edge where you see the painful stuff, and not flinching and not running and not distracting yourself. I'd like to tell you a little bit about an experience I've had the last couple of years, which has been kind of fun, actually, that involves going to that edge and finding out how I usually behave at that edge and how it's possible to alter that. But first, as a kind of intro to this, there's a story I read somewhere. I'm not sure where. It may have been in Crooked Cucumber. One of Shinryo Suzuki's students was walking with him, and it was raining. I think it was raining pretty hard. And Suzuki said to the student, "Don't hurry so much. The rain is everywhere." That's the whole story. Don't hurry so much. The rain is everywhere. What did he mean by that? The student is going to get just as wet, completely wet, whether he hurries or not, right? But he hurries out of habit. It's as if he can somehow escape the moment. It's as if he were wishing the rain away. He's not letting the rain into his world. In his mind, he's already in some dry place. He denies the rain. He's not alive in this moment. Sometimes we do things, like walking in the rain, where we might see vividly how we're not alive in the moment, how we've denied the moment, how we refuse to go there, how this has happened before, and how there's a pattern there. And for each of us, we probably have habitual situations where we try to wish the rain away. I think we probably all have areas of life that we've just decided we're kind of not going into. Sometimes we allow ourselves, though, to be fully immersed in the rain, which means to say that we look thoroughly at the situation. Whatever twists or turns it might take, we're going to stay with it. Whatever it takes to stay with the situation, we're going to be there. We're not going to check out. We're not going to give up. We're not going to quit. For me, I think writing is like that. I write about legal matters for a living. And usually, unless I'm really tired, if I'm reviewing a Supreme Court case or something and I'm writing about that, I'll stay with it. And if there's a part I don't understand, I don't skip over it. I slow down and I read it again, and I read it again, and I think about it very carefully. And if I have to, I do further research. Whatever it takes to get on top of the case, you know, I'm not going to take the small approach to figuring this case out and kind of chip away at it. I'm going to take the big approach and do whatever is needed. But we all have efforts where, or we all have areas of effort where we don't really bring that kind of energy to it. We might say, well, I'll hire somebody to do it, or I'll let somebody else do it, or maybe it just won't get done. You know, people are sometimes about like that with public speaking. A lot of people don't like public speaking, or about math. They're just not going to deal with math, or sewing, or cooking, or maybe they hate to go shopping. I'm like that about home repair, fixing things. I have a lot of trouble with that area. And I really don't know why, because I grew up on a farm, and I've done construction work. I've worked in factories. I've worked in a meat packing plant. I've had plenty of opportunities to work with my hands and take on projects and do whatever it required to get it done. But somehow, I'm just always really quick to throw in the towel. I just say, you know, I'm not doing this. I'll be faced with some little task, some kind of home repair task. And it's just easy for me to think, you know, it's probably going to take me all day to do this. I'm going to go to the hardware store. I'm going to get the wrong thing. I'm going to have to go back. I'll end up going there 3 times. And I'd rather be, you know, working in the garden or meditating or writing a Dharma talk or anything. Just not this one thing. I come to this point where I just want to say, forget it. I'm just not going there. I'm just not going there. But things can change. And this has been changing for me. And what happened there was I met someone a couple years ago, Kathy, whom I'm now married to, and she loves home repair projects. She absolutely loves them. And she let me know this really early on. I think it may have been our first date. It may have been our second date. She said, you know, I just love home repair. I really love home repair. So she was letting me know this is part of the deal. So I love home repair. And so she's always redoing a room or something. She loves power tools. For Christmas, I gave her what she wanted, which was a miter saw. It's this big, big old miter saw and a big old stand. It's really huge. It's a professional type that you can use to rebuild a deck or something. So, and she's better at all this stuff than I am, and I'm not ashamed to say this. And there was one particular time when things really seemed to kind of turn for me a little bit. I mean, actually, it was a series of things, but there was one thing I remember that kind of stands out for me. It was Thanksgiving in 2007. We were planning dinner for 14 people at our house, and the lock, the latch and the lock on the upstairs bathroom was not working properly. You couldn't latch it, so you couldn't properly close the door. And Kathy asked me to replace it because she had lots of other stuff to do. And I immediately got that little sinking feeling that I get, you know, because I hadn't done this before, and it looked simple enough, but I just knew some stuff would go wrong, you know, from past experience. I just knew it would be a big problem, and it would turn into a big, huge deal. But of course, I said, sure, I'll fix it. And so I took a look at it, and I saw it was the latch lock mechanism itself that wasn't working. The little latch was not springing out the way it should. So I just took out two screws, and I took the whole mechanism out, and so I knew I had to get a new one. So I went to Menards, and I got a new one. I tried to match it as closely as possible in size, and I got it home, and I put it in the hole, and I tightened the two screws, and it fit really well, and it was just perfect, but it wouldn't align with the little hole in the strike plate. So I looked at that, and I realized that what I had to do was dig out the wood a little more. And I had to be really precise about that, because if I wasn't, the whole door frame would be messed up, and I'd have an even bigger problem. So I had to go back to Menards to buy a wood chisel so I could be really precise. And I did that. I went back to Menards. I got the wood chisel. I brought the wood chisel home, and I carved out the wood. And I like that part. I like working with wood. I don't like metal or paint or drywall. But I like working with wood. So I attach the strike plate with the two screws, and I close the door, and it latches. It's perfect. And I show Kathy, and I say, look at this. It latches. And she looks at it. She says, that's great. That's really wonderful. And I close it again, and we look at it again, and we go, wait a minute. there's this little thing of the latch. It's flat on one side and it's curved on the other side. And always when you're opening a door into a room, that flat part will be in the back and the rounded part will be here. And I had it on backwards. The flat part was here and the rounded part was here. And you just don't do that. No room is ever like that. And so, this has taken place over the course of about 3 days, because I'm working a little bit here, I'm working a little bit there, I have to go to Menards after work, and now we're coming down to the wire. It's Wednesday afternoon. I take an hour off of work, and I go back to Menards. I hear that little song, you save big money. You say, I'm memorizing this song. And so I'm going to get a lock that goes the other way. And I go there, and none of the locks go the other way, and I don't know what to do. So I talk to the Menards guy. This is another thing I hate, displaying my ignorance to the Menards guy. But I do it. I do it because I have to get through this. He says, you take the lock apart and you flip it over. It's reversible. So, cool. I do that. I take it home. I take it apart. I turn it over. I put it in. It's the next morning by now. And right about the time people are arriving, I get the thing to work. It's just perfect. It works, and I'm so proud of it. And actually, that may be a condensed version of the process. I think I made another trip to Menards in there somewhere, and I'm sure I bought at least two locks at different times. And I'd like to say that I was really patient and really persistent throughout this whole process. But really, there were about 50 times during this whole process where I just wanted to quit. And just say, I'm not going to do this. But there was something different here, which was that I had just resolved to do this no matter what. And I left myself no way out. And so because I left myself no way out, each time that little moment would arise, that little moment where I say, forget it, I'm not doing this, I would see that moment really clearly, and I wouldn't give in to it. And I'd ask myself, what is that moment? What's going on here? What is that moment? That moment is a denial of what is. That moment is a refusal to be. It's as if I'm refusing to let that moment, that situation, into my world, simply because it's difficult. It's as if there could be a separate world without that difficult task in it. It's as if the rain were not everywhere. So when I started to see that moment rather vividly in the home repair process, I started seeing it more and more in other places as well. And I began to sort of welcome that moment a little bit because it seemed like it really had something to teach me. it seemed that I could take that moment and just fully experience that urge to give up, and then just kind of let that moment be one moment in a great series of moments, and just move on from there and just do the thing. And I saw that this is just what happens in meditation too. This moment comes when you want to check out. You may be sitting there in meditation and you're following your breath and you're doing really well. Or you're doing shikantaza and you're doing really well. And all of a sudden something happens and you just check out. You give up. You let your mind wander. You just quit. And what happens there? I began to see that almost inevitably it's simply because it's difficult. You reach this point of difficulty and you just don't want to deal with it. It may be a physical pain. It may be an emotional pain. It may be some combination of the two. You may not even be able to find it. But you don't want to face the discomfort. So that was really helpful to my meditation practice and to my home repair work as well. And we've done a lot of things together since then. Some of them are pretty big. Over several weekends last fall, we rebuilt a garage roof and a deck together. We prepared a house for some renters over a period of several days. And one weekend, the last weekend we were doing this, there was just this crescendo of activity at the end. And it was just kind of this moment of ecstatic transcendence at the end. I replaced the front door lock, again a lock, almost as they were coming up, you know, to take over the house, as Kathy was putting in all these shelves and all the closets downstairs, which she had rebuilt. And it was great. It was like the fifth day of a 7-day sesshin. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic. And what it was having gone to the edge again and again and again, and gotten used to just going over that edge and going through and doing whatever you had to do, which is something that happens after maybe many discouragements. Same thing happens with sesshin. So one thing I've learned from Kathy is that there's always a way to do this stuff. You can always find a way. You take a good look at it. You spend some time with it. If you can't figure it out, you do some research. If your research doesn't help, you find somebody who knows how to do it, and you ask them. And the other thing is, you just expect it to take a lot of time. You expect to make those trips to the store. You expect to get the wrong thing. You expect to return it later. It's okay. It's part of the deal. So here's your assignment. In beginner's mind, I give assignments sometimes, and it's kind of fun. Find an activity in which you can observe yourself coming to that moment where you want to give up and stick with it. Find the thing you hate the most and do that. So how do you like your assignment? Maybe not so much. Maybe not so much. But it's really, it's not so bad. And the reason it's not so bad to do this, to find the thing that you hate the most and use it as an opportunity for growth, is that you don't have to do it alone. And this has to do with the dual nature of refuge. I said that if you understand refuge only as comfort, you can't really understand this practice. But that doesn't mean that we don't have refuge, that comfort is not available to us. Because the thing is, when we do the thing we find that is so difficult, we can get the support of others. We can get the support of others. When I have a home repair problem, I have someone there with me, encouraging me and helping me and teaching me and laughing with me. And here at Zen Center, when it's Rohatsu, it was Rohatsu in the beginning of December, and when I came to a place about 5 or 6 days into Rohatsu where I was so quiet, and I guess my needs had been kind of so quiet that I was able to really be with all of my anxieties and just kind of fully let them in and acknowledge them, all of my anxieties about impermanence and health and aging and things like that. When I was able to let all that stuff in, and not only that, but let in all the people I love and think about their anxieties and the things that can happen to them and all the most scary things there are in the universe, just kind of let all that stuff and be with that, which is something that somehow is very helpful to me in facing this life. I wasn't doing this alone. There were 30 people here all around me, sitting quietly. And I knew they were supporting me, because I knew they were going through the same kinds of things. And they had stuck it out for all these days. I was not alone. So I had the Sangha, and we have the Sangha today. We humans are really needy creatures, and we can rise above need sometimes. This is our life. Samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. Refuge is no refuge. I can sit on my cushion facing the worst that there is, all alone, and I have to be alone, but I need all of you to be able to do that. So I want to continue to take refuge in Sangha in both senses. I want to leave the nest, go to that edge, continually find the place where I want to give up and not give up. That's what I want to do. I want to start anew when I meet a difficult situation. I don't want my old habits of avoidance to kick in. I really want to work on this. But I want to do this with the support of others. And this is a good time to be thinking about this, because it's a new year. It's time to make resolutions. It's time to be a little more serious about things. And things are looking good, you know? Things are looking good in a lot of ways. Zen Center is really thriving. This is a lively place. It's a wonderful place. As a country, we have a new president. There's a lot to be happy about there. And there are difficulties and challenges, of course, too, especially on a personal level. We all have these, and we all know people who are really struggling and really suffering. People who are hurt or discouraged or depressed. You know, even, you know, sometimes we know people who are just at the end of their rope, who have just about had it. And it's possible you're feeling that way yourself. But no matter how you're feeling, no matter what's going on, something small and beautiful happened today, which is that you got up and something made you leave your warm bed and your Sunday morning newspaper and whatever it is, whatever the comforts of home are, and to come here to Zen Center to be with other people and hear this harsh truth in this refuge that is no refuge. And whether this is your first Sunday talk or your 100th Sunday talk, or maybe for someone here it's their 200th Sunday talk, I don't know. There's something really beautiful in that. And if you're new to Zen Center, you may be shy. You may not talk to anyone. You may not feel that bond. You may not feel the strength of Sangha. But stick around and see what happens. You know, sit next to someone for 5 or 6 or 7 days. And even though you don't talk at all that whole time, with respect to that person, you're going to feel Sangha in your bones at the end of that 5 to 7 days. And seeing that, you know, seeing the Sangha here, seeing the deep love and appreciation that lies under all of this, the love and appreciation we have for others, how can you not make a great effort at this practice? How can you not want to renew your vows and try a little harder and get up a little earlier, or maybe meditate a little more, or maybe find that thing you don't like to do and give it another try, whatever it is? You can do this and we can do this. So Happy New Year and thanks for being here. So, are there any comments or any questions? If not, that's okay.
As you were talking, I was thinking to myself, you related a lot to your story about the food trauma project.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that my problem isn't that I want to give up, it's that I keep plodding ahead to getting really angry and upset and frustrated,
mm-hmm.
and even teary about it.
Mm-hmm.
And not wanting to give up and just determining to get it done, even though I'm not. And, but I realized that I think the basis, the root of that response is similar to the root of your response of just wanting to give up, which is the refusal to accept the moment as it is, you know, instead of being able to say, okay, this is what it is right now, I'm having trouble with it, I'm not able to fix the problem right now, and we're putting in to accept that. I reject the fact that that's what the moment is. So I think maybe even though the response is really different, I think a lot of people have a response I have too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Getting really frustrated that the root of that response is really somewhere that you didn't really get your response. I also think I'm not doing it, which is just like an inability or an unwillingness to accept the moment.
Yeah, I think that's true, Jill, and that's really well said. I don't have anything to add to that. It's the same at the root. It's just a different response. Yeah. Thank you.